Five, four, three, two, one.
What's the situation, Captain?
This is Situation Fluxus, a weekly one-hour program focused on jazz and improvised music, news, radio, conversations, and more. Thank you for tuning in to Situation Fluxus on WGXC 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears in upstate New York. I'm your host, Cheryl Kay. Let us dig into the headlines. The three-day 8th Annual Brick Jazz Fest 2022 begins today, October 20th, in downtown Brooklyn, New York. Featured performers include vibist Joel Ross and Parables, vocalist Liz Wright, the Avram Favor Quartet, and Domi and J.D. Beck. For more information, brickartsmedia.org. This evening at Elastic in Chicago, Illinois, the improvised music series presents violinist Mark Feldman, saxophonist Dave Rempis, and drummer Tim Daisy for two sets beginning at 8:30 p.m. CST. For more information, elasticarts.org. Also this evening in Chicago, Illinois, at The Hungry Brain, the ensemble Jaja Wida, Jeb Bishop, Yop Blanc, Weasel Walter, and Damon Smith, 9 p.m. CST. For more information, hungrybrainchicago.com. And tonight at Sony Hall in New York City, drummer Billy Cobham. For more information, club@sonyhall.com. Tomorrow night, Friday, October 21st, the Independent Promoters Alliance, Downtown Music Gallery, and Artist Space in New York City present Francisco Mora Catlett's Afro Horn at 7:30 p.m. and Tzigi Munyo's Cosmic Ensemble celebrating Pharoah Sanders at 9 p.m. For more information, artistspace.org. At Birdland in New York City, inside of Birdland Theater tonight, October 20th, the Michael Wolf Trio, 8:30 p.m. And this Friday through Sunday, the Gabriel Stravelli Quartet for two sets. And inside of Birdland Jazz Club this Sunday, October 23rd, the Vanessa Rachi Quartet, 5:30 p.m. and Arturo O'Farrell and the Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra for two sets. For more information, birdlandjazz.com. This Friday and Saturday night, October 21st and 22nd, at the Jazz Forum in Tarrytown, New York, bassist John Patitucci with his Brazilian trio for two sets. And on Sunday, October 23rd, drummer Barry Altschulz, pianist Edsel Gomez, bassist Joe Fonda, and saxophonist Peter Brannan for two sets. For more information, jazzforumarts.org. Saxophonist Dennis Mitcheltree is on tour in support of his latest release, Golden Rule, and his next stop is at Jazz Central Studios in Minneapolis, Minnesota, on Saturday, October 22nd. For more information, dennismitcheltree.com. Elysium Furnace Works presents the trio of pianist Marilyn Crispell, bassist Joe Fonda, and drummer Harvey Sorgan inside the VBI Theater of the Kenneen Hackett Arts Center in Poughkeepsie, New York, on Saturday, October 22nd, 8 p.m. For more information, kenneen-hackett.org or visit Elysium Furnace Works on Facebook. On Saturday, October 22nd, 7 p.m., the Independent Promoters Alliance in New York City presents bassist Ken Filiano, drummer Lou Grassi, plus a special guest on piano at Machico Studios, Stage 2. For more information, downtownmusicgallery.com. Also this Saturday, October 22nd, at the Louis Armstrong House Museum at 1 p.m. in Queens, New York, Armstrong Now, Garden Concert and Panel, featuring artist-in-residence, drummer Ulysses Owens Jr. For more information, louisarmstronghouse.org. Drummer Bernard Purdy and friends appear at the Falcon in Marlborough, New York this Saturday night, and on Sunday, October 23rd, trumpeter Wallace Roney Jr.'s Gangway at 7 p.m. For more information, liveatthefalcon.com. On his second album as a leader, acclaimed saxophonist Owen Broder pays tribute to one of his heroes, saxophonist Johnny Hodges. Hodges, Front and Center, Volume 1, explores the jazz great's legacy, including his key role with the Duke Ellington Orchestra and beyond. Broder and his ensemble are on tour in support of this album. On Tuesday, October 25th, at Blues Alley in Washington, D.C., Wednesday, October 26th, at Chelsea Table and Stage in New York City, and on Thursday, October 27th, at Pausa Art House in Buffalo, New York. For more information, owenbroder.com. And now for new and upcoming releases. Trumpeter Michael Sarian's Living at the End of the World on Eyes and Ears. Playfield's Stepping Out on 577. Pianist Noam Lemish's 12 on TPR. And drummer Anthony Tadeo's Le Trait Sorel on Shifting Paradigm. All news items have been gathered from various media sources. For the latest updates, contact the source, venue, or business. Remember, I'm just the messenger. Well, before our time runs out, let's get to it, shall we?
Great.
Okay. My interview is with author Richard Colota. His book, Holy Ghost, The Life and Death of Free Jazz Pioneer Albert Ayler, is about the life of avant-garde saxophonist, singer, and composer Albert Ayler. It comes out next month. So I want to thank you, Richard, for joining me here on Situation Fluxus.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I do interviews is for my own education and new perspectives. In reading Holy Ghost, The Life and Death of Free Jazz Pioneer Albert Ayler, I learned about his military, religious, and spiritual life. Situations in his life seem to trigger opportunities and awakenings in these areas, like the reason he joined the military to avoid child support payments, which afforded him time to travel and perform. His religious and spiritual nature, formed by his attendance at church with his family, helped him partially define the meaning in his music. How did you come to know about Albert and his family?
Well, interesting story. I had a lot of his records. Actually, ironically, Anton Fire sold me one of the first Ayler albums I bought. I used to buy the promos from him off the market. But and ironically, I was at a book sale in Middleburg Heights, and I bought a copy of Leonard Feather's Encyclopedia of Jazz in the 60s. And I was thumbing through it, and I had a radio show. I mean, now I'm just at this point of filling in on college radio. I mean, I had my fun 30 years ago. I don't need to, I'd rather have them explore new students. But, well, back then I was there, and I just didn't call him up. His number was actually in the book, and I asked him, would you like to be on my show? And he was really a good guy. He gave me, it was at 11 o'clock at night yet. So him and his father drove down, and we talked for about 3 hours. And he really gave me the idea to do the book. He wanted it to be, shall we say, a joint project. He wanted after royalties, which I would not have minded paying. But the problem was, is what I wanted from them was so we say, family photos. You know, his father had a great scrapbook, which no one knows what happened to. Some of it wound up in Revenant's books, but there are other ones I saw that are basically buried with him or whatever.
And Albert's father, his name is Edward?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he was a wonderful guy. And I hung out with Don. I visited Donnie. And they came out another time in the show after a rather scurrilous article appeared in the Plain Dealer. But what happened is Donnie just gave me this. He had a good memory, but he'd give me the same interview over and over again. And he would do it word for word that he did it to Bob Rush from Cadence. And there was nothing new. I only learned a few new things, like the story of the heroine when they went to Spirits Rejoice, and the story about the child support. Ironically, Carrie had contacted Jeff Schwartz, so I already had the name of, you know, who to contact about that story. And she welcomed me into her home, and we talked to her about, I videoed it, and she we welcomed for an hour. But Donnie gave me the idea to do it. And like I said, if he had been more cooperative, like, you know, but he didn't have any pictures or anything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what can I say? You know, anything, you can tell mostly with mine, there was nothing that, it was very minimal contributions except for some of the other things. But then it's fascinating to look at what he did. You know, he bragged about his baseball skills and his trip to Sweden. That took like 3 pages, no, 4 pages in the original manuscript, where he went off to Sweden with his friend. And I realized, no, he was just BS, you know, for lack of a better word, bragging the whole time. And it was like, well, there's no way it'll wind up in a book. I mean, my original book I used to call the Urtext, because it was like 500 pages, and it got edited down heavily, but I'm very happy they turned what was basically read like a doctoral dissertation into a readable book, because I would print these whole reviews in there, and I didn't have to repeat people's thing what they repeated. But some people were very, very generous about their writings, like Gary Giddens says, instead of using a Village Voice article I wrote, use this one. And he gave me carte blanche, as did John Littweiler and Scott Yanow and a few others, to just say, take my writing, and Vel did too. Just take anything you want from my writing, or just footnote it. You know, and I mean, they were very generous. You know, I mean, it's rough in a way, because the pictures are great, you know. And I made some new other friends besides Donnie, because he introduced me to his friend Clyde Shai, who's now known as Mudawaf Shaheed. He says, told me, you and Clyde, he still called him Clyde, are the two smartest people I've ever met. And him, Clyde, Shaheed and me became really good friends. He brought some other people on the station when I did the interviews, like Larry Hancock. And there was a couple other ones that he introduced. Bobby Few. He had Bobby Few come on the he bumped into him when he was in town, says, you got to hang with Richard. And so Bobby Few was great. I've got videos of it, and in his home. Same with Jimmy Landers, you know, so he was a great source. I gave him I gave him a copy of the book. His mother's hitting 100. And so I gave her one of the preview copies, so he could show it to his mom, you know, I mean, and she loved it, you know. But it's just fascinating how I got into it. I kept persevering with all the rejection notices. I knew there was going to be a thing for it. And fortunately, Lloyd, my agent, got me in with Chabo, which is like, wow. Which I really think is a lot better than, you know, a university press, because it's a popular book, you know, popular press with rock and roll stuff. And then, you know, it was funny, the last weekend I'm catching type. I had another friend. I had two friends who would go through it. Or three or four friends, like Patrick Reagan from the Eiler website, and my friend Pierre, who did the translations from French. They both went through it and were catching things that were typos. My former boss's wife went through it, and she caught some typos that slipped in. Another friend of mine read it, and he was catching things that I didn't know. Like, for example, you do not say Ohio State University. It is said the Ohio State University. And then the way it's spelled, the nursing home, Braveview, he knew that to spell. So I was really doing this. And then Patrick at the last minute caught up and says, I had it written as a Munich, as an Amsterdam TV concert. And I realized, or he caught it, that it wasn't, it was Munich. They just showed it on Amsterdam TV in 1970. So he did not play Amsterdam in 66. He just, but he played Munich. And that's what I caught that last second. So I'm wired up on coffee this whole weekend, proofing it, as well as theirs. I had to go in court. I mean, I had 4 hours of sleep, I think, for the weekend. I walk into court Monday on 4 hours of sleep. And actually, it's funny. I won the biggest verdict I ever did against a slumlord, not a slum, I call him a scam lord. He would rent, do these rent-to-own propositions on single mothers. And he'd give them these. And then when they fixed up the place enough, he'd find an excuse to evict them. And I had all this stuff from him, but he never got a renter's permit because he was trying to fly under the radar of paying local city income tax. And I argued, if you don't have the renter's permit, it violates the health code and you can't charge rent. And the judge agreed with me. I mean, it's fun, you know, sometimes. I mean, I was in music school, and what happened is I was a union negotiator, and I remembered their side was their lawyers, the management side said, you people are lucky to have chops, which floored me. I saw my boss shake her head. I said, screw it. I am going to get out of here. And I went to law school. But by the time I got out of law school, they fired her, and they fired the other idiot I couldn't stand. We used to call her Mein Kampf, the sequel. I mean, really. And they fired them both, and I went from being the bottom at the library to being the top again. But working at the library gave me a really great idea, you know, how to hunt stuff down.
Yeah,
I knew enough, I mean, plus the master's in musicology, but I knew most of that stuff from the library work I did. And always just to do it. I mean, just to hunt something down, because you'll find it somewhere. And Googling, Google searches work out great. But, you know, you have to sometimes sort out what's junk on Google and what's not. But that helped me a lot, the library, just going in there and, you know, having access to interlibrary loan and getting articles from Orchester Journal in Swedish. And my German was pretty good when I read the Peter White version of the book. By the way, his I still respect his writings, because he beats, I'll admit, he beats me on analysis. I felt more of the history of the world was more important to tell. But I was, when I did some of the translations, I think my matched up all the way up with Jane White's. I mean, I was pretty much on the money every time. I think the one difference is I wrote he laughed and she wrote he smiled. And so I was very close. But and I had students who could help me translate from, and I never bothered asking their names to help me with the translations from the Swedish things. And I used to hear from it from interlibrary loan, why are you getting this junk? But you know, it also got to be frustrating in a way, because I had to pull from my IRA about $1,200 to get the photo rights. And some, you know, obviously they deserve to be compensated. But it burned me ego, because they just fired the president of the university for being an incompetent, but give him $1 million buyout. But they can't give me, you know, they wouldn't give a flunky who worked at the library money to get pictures done. But it's also interesting, it's how much places wanted, like, for a paragraph from the Vogue, which Nat Hentoff wrote, they wanted $250 for a 60-year-old article. New York Times wanted $500 for the reprints of the, so I just synopsized it, you know, forget them clowns. But they wanted $500 for the review of the Newport concert by somebody. The Plain Dealer wanted $200 for each picture. And, well, it turned out it was just a stock photo, so I chose not to use it. It's interesting, I mean, and like I said, it was great that last weekend that, like I said, there were certain pictures I wanted to use definitely, and others I just asked the publisher to pick out whatever looks best for them, which was the Fondation pictures, the stuff from the Jazz Institute, because I knew they had more of a mind to see what would work for them. I mean, there were certain pictures I wanted, like that 1949 photo of him at the playground. I was in pre-bullion days. I went through every issue of the Call-In Post on microfilm, because I remembered every kid who was African-American got their picture in the paper on their birthday. and they had all these birthday parties. I was looking for one of Albert. Turned out they showed up on the bullion search, but I missed them the first time. But I saw that sick picture, and I knew he was there from 1949. And his cousin confirmed where he was. I got the what we call the mug shots of the school, their school pictures, which was great. You know, and some of that stuff is really fascinating to get. There's one I'm disappointed. It was just so bad I couldn't use it. It was from a high school newspaper. John Adams, he's playing sax in a pit band. And yeah, you know, what they call when you were in the school band and you had to accompany some the local show. And I recognized him right away, but the picture is just too bad to use.
During his service in the military as a musician, and this was, he signed up in, I believe, 1958.
Right.
He traveled to different countries in Europe and gained recognition, but not always positive reviews. Would you discuss this time in his life and its effect on his future playing style?
Basically, he got some kind of religion in there, because before, when he was at Fort Knox, he had that style. It was mostly an R&B style. And he gets it. Somehow he goes to Europe and he's just, it expanded his mind. But he was not playing in clubs. He would only play at certain clubs back then, because it wasn't really like the 1962 Stockholm adventures. But he would just play and go off there and then play at some of these clubs. And basically, it wasn't necessarily that he was any good. The local audiences in Stockholm and Paris, they just wanted to see an African-American guy play. I mean, Imam Shahid told me, he said they wanted me to play, and just because he played bass. And he said he never played it before, but he said just because I'm an African-American, it was a selling point to them when he visited. And it was the same point with Albert joining at the clubs in Stockholm back when he was in taking leaves from the army. But he did impress people like Peter Brotzman. So, yeah, but it just had, he had some kind of spiritual awakening in the army, I think. Because when he came back, it was just so, all the people who said how great he was couldn't stand his playing anymore, like Lloyd Pearson and all of those. Mm. It's like Lloyd said, that guy sure got weird. And so, what was it? What was he exposed to in Europe?
Hmm.
But they were more accessible. It's interesting because he went to the one thing in Stockholm, which was actually where, Perry Robinson played. And actually, that was a communist front. That was sponsored by the Communist Party. It was one of those communist front things that they invited all these people to play.
It's interesting that you mentioned Sweden. You know, he would go back to Sweden more often because of his initial exposure during the military. The painter and journalist Daniel Coe, in a 2010 article from the book Testimonials on a Holy Ghost, I hope I translated that correctly, surmised that the dismissal by American audiences and the press did him in psychologically.
Yes.
In your book, you report that his hometown of Cleveland, Ohio, barely acknowledged his death. Is it your hope that this book reclaims some of the fame and recognition that he was denied?
Yes, I do want it to be known, because it just, they just give a little blurb in the Plain Dealer and in the Call and Post. And it's like they totally forgot him. But he didn't play in Cleveland that much. I think I've documented the few Cleveland performances he did.
Yeah.
The WHK, the LaCav, and then that when he joined Jimmy Landers at the last thing. But they didn't acknowledge. But the papers weren't that, oh, it's hard to say. They didn't acknowledge a lot of people in the paper. I mean, Coltrane didn't get a review at all, probably, either. It's just, you know, Donnie got a full half-page article thanks to Tom Farron, because I wrote to him when he died.
Your chapter titled Beginning of the End, the death of saxophonist John Coltrane, Eiler's tensions with Impulse Records, the dissolution of his relationship with his brother, who you've mentioned, trumpeter Donald Eiler. That's what was happening to him, happening around him in the mid and late 60s. Richard, how do you see it as the beginning of the end of Albert Eiler?
Because he drifted away from, he went totally away from the avant-garde and made what was basically bad R&B. But on the other hand, it's one thing I heard about when they were editing is it says, there's people from modern magazines like Pitchfork who think that stuff is great. And I have to listen to it again with new ears. I mean, there's, I do like it, you know, like Music is the Healing Force, some of those. I actually like those CDs. I just went off all of the reviews because the way they panned them. Now, what I wasn't going to put, go out there and say anything great, because it was just sort of the same thing. But it was that he wanted recognition. Mm-hmm. He made an album. If they had given him another chance, or he had deep sixed Mary Maria and gone asked Laura Nero to write for him, it would have really worked out great. And if they had given him another chance. But I know from Impulse, Donnie once said, I didn't put this in the book, because, and Albert had, you probably have to use the beep button, but he said he took it up the ass with Impulse. And Donnie said, and I was right there behind him getting screwed. Now, and he said it to, I know he said it to John Goldman. I, for some reason, just left it out because it was, you know, he just, he made, and the question is, was he forced by Impulse, as some people claim, to do the pop stuff? And he said in his interview with Daniel Koch, it was I made an R&B record better than anyone ever did. And he liked his stuff. He was just his problem was he was just so, he had no points to look at anything. If he had hung around, it could have been as good as anything Herbie Hancock had done later on. We all make mistakes sometimes in our, you know, branching off. And by the way, he did not have falling out with Donnie, because he did join him. He was going to ask Donnie to join him in France. Donnie just had mental problems, but I always remembered he never hired another trumpeter after Donnie. Mm-hmm. After Donnie, he just changed directions, and he changed directions every time, and people left. And obviously, he didn't have another pianist. He only used him once, called Cobbs once or twice. So he just didn't see Donnie. It was not more or less Donnie's problems, but rather Donnie's trumpeting was just not, a trumpeter was just not in the cards for the next round of music.
But that's where I see another story being told in Holy Ghost, that of Donald, who outlived Albert by about 35 years.
Yeah.
I see their relationship somewhere between symbiotic and codependent. How would you describe it?
Probably just as you did, though. His parents, now there's something I couldn't put in the book because it was told me in confidence, so we won't discuss it here. But it was basically his parents pushed Albert to accept, put Donnie in the band. And they just wanted him. Now, the problem is Donnie was, how you say, his head was full of himself, if you know what I mean. He was a big, he had a super ego, And so, you know, that was one of the big problems, I think, is that just that it was codependent, because he simplified his music to make room for Donnie's style. And it's why you'll see at LaCave why it was they played the same stuff over and over again, because Donnie was not capable probably of learning new music. On the other hand, he wrote Our Prayer, which Gary Giddens classified as one of the greatest jazz songs of the jazz compositions of the 1960s. I know Santana plays it. So Donnie was good in his own, on his own terms. I listened to the YouTube, the Don Eiler and Florence album, some of it, and it was really pretty good. He just fell by the wayside when people sort of like Kenny G when became into jazz, and they just sort of forgot the avant-garde, and he was one of the pioneers of the avant-garde, and they just forgot about him. It's like all these people in the 1920s bands, like King Oliver and Bunk Johnson. No one wanted to hear that stuff because it was so square anymore. Mm-hmm. So no one wanted to hear the avant-garde jazz because it was more or less get your Porsche like Kenny G and a few other guys do. You know, I mean, there's very few people who are modern that I actually, I mean, or contemporaries I listen to. I mean, I don't own any Kenny G albums. I don't own a lot of the people. But it's just that avant-garde jazz fell by the way. It became a niche, but he influenced more the rock, as I wrote, the rock and roll musicians like Tom Verlaine. I gave Verlaine a copy of my manuscript at the Beachland. There's a picture of it on Facebook. But he stuck around for 6 minutes and was asking me questions about Eiler. And again, there's someone like Pat Metheny I gave a copy to, and he used to ask about a lot. So some of the people, like, it was rock and roll musicians. Patti Smith used to write reviews of Eiler, and I was hoping I could put in a bibliography, because wow, she wrote it for an underground newspaper, and she mentioned an autobiography, but I just couldn't find it. There were things that eluded me. Then there's things that, like the classic one was a yearbook with Albert Eiler. I wanted a picture of him on the golf team. And I finally, even after I went to press, I found a 1955 John Adams yearbook, but there was no picture of him in it. And ironically, through the school newspaper's microfilms, I found out my high school phys ed teacher was on the golf team with him. And I called up his widow, but that's where I found out he was not in the yearbook. Some people just did not get yearbook photos. Donnie wasn't in there. The only picture of Donnie I found in the yearbook was him running hurdles.
But one person who did not forget Donald Eiler was trumpeter Wodato Leo Smith.
Right.
He credits him as an influence on his style. I never knew that.
I heard that from the guy at Braxton House, Victor. It's a long Russian name. His last name begins with P. And somehow he wrote me about that. But he said Wodato Leo. That's where I got that from. Was just an email. And so, you know, it's like that. It's also just fascinating. It was just that he did influence a lot of people, but who knows? Yeah. He just didn't appreciate himself in his own life. Adani didn't appreciate himself in his own lifetime.
Yeah. I'm not one who obsessively indulges in conspiracy theories. So the speculation of how Albert Eiler died doesn't interest me. His life story does. Richard, you spent 6 years researching his life. What did his life story mean to your life story?
Just, I guess, sticking to something and just not get depressed about failures. I mean, or people doing it. I mean, you think, it's mostly like, let's put it this way, what could mental health have done for him now? Right. I mean, I look at my buddy Anton. He went to Switzerland for a suicide trip, and Anton Fire. And, you know, so what could mental health have done? How much could it have helped Donnie as well? Donnie fell through the cracks badly. And what should it have? That's the big thing, is what, to me, it's being more compassionate towards mentally ill type situations. Mm. and not make jokes about it like he used to do on late night radio.
My interview with author Richard Kolota. Music from saxophonist Albert Eiler. For more information, jawbonepress.com. You're listening to Situation Fluxus on WGXC 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears in upstate New York. I'm your host, Cheryl Kay. Please send your comments, quips, and anecdotes, as well as feedback to thejazzdisturbance@gmail.com. For more information about the show, jazzfluxus.com. And now for some music. We'll be right back.
From its release of last month, the tune Waltz of the Flowers from the New York Afro Bop Alliance Big Band's Angel Face release, the Pan American Nutcracker Suite. Before this, from award-winning drummer and composer Henry Godfrey, who received his bachelor's degree in jazz composition from the Berklee College of Music in 2018 and his master's degree from the New England Conservatory of Music in 2020. His September self-release is Attitude and Gratitude, and we heard Hot Water. And from Calgary-based improviser Jairus Sharif's release on Telephone Explosion Records, Water and Tools, we heard his composition Dr. Teddy's High Test. Sharif composed all of the tunes, performed on all of the instruments, and recorded and produced the album. Thank you for tuning in to Situation Fluxus, produced for and airing on WGXC, 90.7 FM, a listener-supported radio for open ears in upstate New York. I've been your host, Cheryl Kay. Tune in next Thursday at 10 a.m. for another show. I also host the Jazz Disturbance on the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 5th Sunday of each month from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on WGXC. WGXC.org. For more information about Situation Fluxus, thejazzdisturbance@gmail.com or jazzfluxus.com. Thank you.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.